Welcome to Radio Contra, the podcast of American Partisan, the home of the Mossy Oak Militia, the boys who are always DTB. That's Down to Boogaloo and coming live from the Tactical Operating Center in the rural foothills of North Carolina. I'm NC Scout, your host, and the first American casualty of coronavirus. Yeah, that is where I've been. I totally had coronavirus, and it's all right. I took two shots of Jim Beam and a dose of Keys, and it's totally healed up, man. It's crazy. But no, seriously, it's good to be back with you. It's been a few weeks since we last spoke. I've had a very intense training schedule. We had an intelligence course in the Northeast. That was absolutely awesome. It is always a huge blessing whenever I get to run a course, especially one where I'm covering new material that I haven't done before. And, you know, the intelligence course that I offered was one that is focused on ground intelligence collection, something that I was trained to do when I was in the Army. And specifically covering targeting. And it's something that really isn't taught very often in many other contexts. So it was a whole lot of fun. And I had some really, really cool people that came into the class that had a lot of experience doing this. And to have them in class and share their experiences, and then to come to me at the end of class and say that they got a whole lot out of it, was a really, really huge honor. But since then, I've had a couple other private classes, and I've had very little downtime on my own. My feet were barely on the ground, and I've got a carbine course coming up this weekend here in North Carolina. And I'm really looking forward to that. I'm always looking forward to making dangerous men more dangerous. And speaking of that, this segment is brought to you by our site affiliate and sponsor, as well as a really, really cool company, Palmetto State Armory. Right now, as of this time, I do not know of a firearms company in America that is more pro Second Amendment than Palmetto State Armory. I communicate with them fairly regularly via email and the occasional phone call, and every time it is emphasized, their stated goal as a company is to put so many firearms in the hands of the American citizens, you, that no gun buyback, no gun confiscation, literally nothing that Big Gov wants to do will have any effect. And I would also like to give a shout out to another really awesome company, Primary Arms. You know, so you got that cool guy rifle. Now you need to get a good optic for it. And if you are just getting into things, not really sure what you need to buy, maybe you're kind of on a tight budget, but you still want that good quality to be there. Primary Arms makes some of the coolest optics that are on the market right now. The ACSS reticle, the Advanced Combat Sighting System. This weekend's class, I will be teaching a course yet again with more Primary Arms optics, and I will be beating the crap out of their optics out there. There's going to be pictures on American Partisan next week. I'll probably be beating the crap out of the rifle that one of them is mounted on, too. Just to prove a point. Prove a point about the AR-15 system. A lot of people, not to get on a tangent, but a lot of people like to say, you know, oh, the AR is not reliable, blah, blah, blah. Bullshit. Bullshit. The AR-15 platform is an incredibly reliable weapon. It's just different. It's different. You know, everybody loves to get into the whole AK versus AR nonsense. We'll be talking about the AK a little bit later on in the podcast, but I don't get into that. I don't get into that stuff. I just love talking about the weapons. I love making people dangerous with no matter what they have in their hands, because it is not the weapon, it is the man behind it. All right. Anyway, primary arms, really good stuff for the money. Optics are very, very good, and they range from very inexpensive, kind of the their classic line, I think they're calling it their silver line, all the way up to their platinum line, which is made in Japan using Japanese glass, very high-end, high-quality optics. You know, so you've got it all. But it's good stuff. It's just good stuff. So go check them out. Primary Arms.
Mandrake, I suppose it never occurred to you that while we're chatting here so enjoyably, a decision is being made by the President and the Joint Chiefs in the war room at the Pentagon. And when they realize there is no possibility of recalling the wing, there will be only one course of action open. Total commitment. Mandrake, do you recall what Clemenceau once said about war?
No, I didn't think I knew that, yeah.
He said war was too important to be left to the generals. When he said that, 50 years ago, he might have been right. But today, war is too important to be left to politicians. They have neither the time, the training, nor the inclination for strategic thought. I can no longer sit back and allow communist infiltration, communist indoctrination, communist subversion, and the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
That was a quote from Dr. Strangelove. Classic movie, man. Classic movie. Peter Sellers, Sterling Hayden, the incredible, legendary George C. Scott, and Stanley Kubrick directing it. Really an incredible movie, and one of those that was definitely a product of its time. But the ironic thing about that is, well, there's a lot of ironies about that movie. But the ironic thing is that we find ourselves once more kind of examining the same things that General Ripper, that was just there having a conversation with Group Captain Mandrake, we find ourselves kind of looking back on that and saying maybe he had a point. I think that he did. Of course, one of the ironic things about General Ripper, played by legendary B-movie actor Sterling Hayden, is that Sterling Hayden was an interesting fellow himself. He earned the Silver Star, was an OSS agent, was a Marine under a false name, and then later on, after World War II, joined the American Communist Party. The irony, right? The great irony of General Ripper and the man behind him. But with that being said, you know, General Ripper might have not been wrong about everything. Of course, he was certainly a parody of the legendary general, what many consider the father of the modern Air Force, and certainly the Strategic Air Command, General Curtis LeMay. But they were in an era where communist infiltration was very real. And, you know, throughout the 80s, 90s, 2000s, the American left has turned McCarthyism and that era into the New Age witch hunts. And yet we look back on the findings of the Un-American Activities Committee. They weren't wrong. Oh, no. No, no, no. And when we watch the Democratic debate, the rolling dumpster fire that is the Democratic presidential candidate field, just check it out, man. I mean, we have a literal communist, the guy vacationed in the Soviet Union. Oh, I'm a socialist. Oh, I'm not a communist. I'm a socialist. Yeah. Okay, buddy. Well, you know, and then we've got a bunch of others in the field that claim that they're not, but they are. You know, we've got Elizabeth Warren. Oh, don't you love Elizabeth Warren? The Harvard law professor. Harvard. Another great irony there with her, but she's kind of socialist light, like the corporatist version of socialism. Basically, it's like when Monster first came out and Red Bull came out, all these energy drink companies came out. And then, you had Coke and Pepsi kind of introduce theirs. You know, they didn't really sell as well. You know, that's kind of where Elizabeth Warren is right now. That's kind of how I think of her. And there's this Amy Klobuchar or whatever her name is. Nobody really knows what she's about. And I don't think that it really matters that much either. And then Mayor Pete, the Intel agency guy, we've got an interesting article up about that too on American Partisan, some of his ties to the intelligence community, some of his activities from overseas, and, you know, some of the stuff from kind of tiptoeing around those types and working around some of those types. It certainly adds up, but to me, just as a guy looking at this objectively, dude seems a little too rehearsed to me. Just a little too rehearsed. But hey, could be wrong about that. I don't know. But the great irony of the Democrat Party today is that, like the point that I was making about Elizabeth Warren, the Democrat Party is kind of there. You know, they are kind of they used to be when I was growing up, the party of the working class. But now it seems to have become the party of everybody who's angry for the sake of being angry, and rich, spoiled white liberals who, you know, with their acid bears on the back of their Land Rovers, say that they're going to stand up and combat climate change. Uh-huh. It is what it is, man. Nothing personal, just an observation, just one man's observation. You know, and I know not everybody on the left is like that, but for the most part, that is what you see. Limousine liberals, I think, is what the phrase used to be. I'm not so sure. That's accurate anymore. I don't really know. Maybe if Tesla, if you know, Elon Musk is making limousines, I'm not sure. But getting back to the General Ripper quote, you know, he wasn't wrong, man. He wasn't wrong. And America has been fully infiltrated by communists. I would say that the communist influence, the Marxist influence, has certainly had a trickle-down effect through academia, at least for the past 60 years, if not further. But the question that I have, and the one that I haven't seen asked yet, is what happens when the communists become capitalists? To get the wheels turning a little bit, because there's very few communists that I know, and you know, I know some folks that I would consider on the fairly far left end of things, and you know, a lot of them, when you go out to if you go out to a protest, you know, heaven forbid you go out and check out what the other side might have to say, But when you do, a lot of them decry the working class and whatnot. However, very few of them actually labor. It's kind of an interesting irony. But with that being said, to my larger point is, what happens when communists, people who are fully indoctrinated on the left, become capitalists? I mean, we see this in the IT profession. We see this in the larger tech industries. We see this in retail. What happens when dyed-in-the-wool Marxists become capitalists? And I would say that this is really nothing new. A lot of the American industrialists, the wealthy elite, this is kind of where Bloomberg's coming from. And some of his stuff, as I was traveling over this last week, I heard the usual stuff on some of the conservative outlets that were just all up in arms about what Bloomberg had to say about American farmers and whatnot. And one thing that stood out to me, while obviously I don't agree or am willing to defend Bloomberg on anything, is that he wasn't entirely wrong in the larger point that he was making. He just made it in a really awful way. And that's one of his big issues, is that he's not smart enough to, I mean, he's obviously intelligent, but he's not smart enough to be able to convey complex ideas to people in a way that doesn't come off as being arrogant or sounding like an asshole. But his issue that he, or the, I would say the larger issue that he was talking about, was the fact that automation is replacing a lot of blue collar jobs. Now, he said it in a really horrible way, but with that being said, automation is replacing a lot of blue-collar jobs, and this is a major question that is going to come up in politics. And to his larger point, at the end of what he was saying at the clips that I've heard, he said, you know, that one thing that's keeping these people from operating the guillotines, probably for people like him, the one thing that's keeping them from operating the guillotines on the elites is the dignity of having a job. And he's not entirely wrong about that. You know, the cost of automation will be very high. You know, I discussed with some folks a while back now in one of the classes, I think it was a tracking class, that we had last fall, late summer, early fall. But that, you know, AI, I think, is the largest political issue that nobody's talking about right now. AI, the issues that we're going to have with AI and the technological revolution that's going to come about of AI, with a massively displaced industrial labor population, is going to cause some problems. And we have to have a way, a competent answer for that, because if we don't, the answers that the left are going to give with universal basic income and essentially socialism and communally owned property, which is communism, that's going to be the answer that ends up getting accepted by the masses. And that is a dangerous prospect. That not only that, but the fact that privacy is going to be non-existent at that point. With what we know about machine learning and Google and, you know, the creepy line, which is a really interesting documentary you should check out. The tools that they have, the facial recognition software, literally everything, the human terrain mapping that they can do, that's nearly all automated. This is really dangerous stuff, and it's something that you need to be aware of, you know. And you know, to that point, I'd also like to say that there's been a lot of folks out there, different things that have come up recently, protests and whatnot, I'm already on the list, or I don't want to be there, or whatever. You know, this all-encompassing list, Eye of Sauron, or whatever it is. You're already on it. But as I was talking about in the intelligence course just a few weeks ago, and has been covered in other classes I've run that were intelligence-based, intelligence is a game of constant updates. It is not necessarily what I know if I have a list of targets, but I need to be able to have a steady set of parameters of which it's information that I'm gathering about a target, right? And people change over time. I need to know I have RFIs or requests for information when I'm building a targeting packet. And that goes stale after a certain amount of time, depending on what it is. So what that has to do with your personal operational security is that you may not take it seriously now, and you may look at it like, well, whatever, I'm already on the list, whatever that is, and whatnot. But what you're failing to understand is that you're constantly giving the machine, whether it's a person that's actually sitting there, an intelligence analyst that's actually sitting there, whether it's a ground intelligence collector, somebody like me in my past life, or whether it is the machine itself, they are constantly trying to map out your patterns of life. And that's something that you need to consider. And if that doesn't matter to you, then that doesn't matter to you. And, there's nothing that I'm going to say or anybody else is going to say that's really going to matter. And you've probably already tuned out, and that's fine. I'm not really talking to you folks anyway. But to those who are paying attention and who care and want to be a threat to the machine, you might ought to pay attention to what we had to say. And on that note, we have a class coming up for that, Privacy, Security, and Anonymity, taught by my friend and soon-to-be retired special operations guy, all-around stand-up guy, goes by the code name Kilo. He covers everything. It's not just internet security, but it's basic rules for living tradecraft, whether it's online, whether it's in person. And we cover a lot of stuff in that class. He teaches this to current serving special operations personnel. So you might want it. You might want it. At what we're charging for the class, $300 to come out. You're going to have a good time. I promise we'll take really good care of you for the weekend. You're going to learn some good stuff, meet some good folks, and get some really good information. If you're interested in that, shoot me an email, brushbeater@tutanota.com, and I will be more than happy to get you the information on that course. We've got just a few slots left, so if you want it, come on out, get in on it, while you can. I don't know how many more times he is going to teach this to civilians, so, once it's gone, it's gone. So if you want it, get it. Anyway, moving on, getting back to this question of what happens when the capitalists, or should I say, what happens when the commies become the capitalists, and what happens when the capitalists become the commies. And going back to Nixon and China, in contemporary American humanities studies at the university level, Nixon is treated like the literal Antichrist. And when you've got sociology undergrads, they will, in their 400 level classes, will get treated to literally everything, all of the social issues that we have today, a lot of divisiveness between the races and whatnot, all that's blamed on Richard Nixon. Now, we know a lot of this is false. I'm certain that he didn't do anything to help matters, but they gloss over the fact that Lyndon B. Johnson was actually a real big proponent of a lot of the modern era stuff that we have today, the institutional poverty and whatnot. But they like to gloss over that fact. But anyway, not here to judge, just an observer. But Nixon, probably more famously than anything else, went to China. And the policies on China run through Henry Kissinger and established by Henry Kissinger, who's the architect for a lot of this, have hinged on trade agreements. And what we've seen from the 1980s, that was 1970s with Nixon, Kissinger, and China, through the 80s, kind of quiet. We had a lot going on in the Latin American region and South America, and then Iran-Contra, of course. But moving forward into the 90s, it started popping up here and there. There was money being donated to Clinton campaigns from Chinese nationals. There was theft of nuclear secrets from Los Alamos Nuclear Laboratory. There was the publishing by two People's Liberation Army colonels of a book called Unrestricted Warfare, where it was literally a blueprint of how to take down the United States, beginning with a terrorist attack, much like what happened in 9/11. It's very, very interesting how this has worked out. And the further that we go, the more that we see the ties between China and our institutions of influence and institutions of control here in the United States. Hollywood. And that brings us back to General Ripper and Sterling Hayden, who was an American communist. What he knew then and what he testified to, the Un-American Activities Committee, and what he was questioned on by the FBI, all of that is readily accessible. And it's interesting what he had to say. Think of what could be and would be said today. Huh. It's awfully interesting. What about all our trade agreements? The one-sided trade agreements, literally, I would argue, the primary policy that got Trump elected in the Rust Belt was the imbalanced trade agreements, which have benefited China and created them as an economic powerhouse. They went from a third-world agrarian society to a third-world country with a first-world economy in about 20 years. And the reason that they have Wu flu, coronavirus, and whatnot, SARS before that, and good Lord, whatever else they have that we don't know. The reason they have all of that is because their ethics aren't there. Their society did not evolve, but their economy did. Just like giving a teenager $1 million budget and a really fancy car, it ain't gonna work. That was what they did. I argue that it was exploitation of cheap labor while exploiting the lower classes in America through Walmart and Target. They exploited cheap labor in China while exploiting the lower classes in America. And through both, you build up one while you keep down the other. That's what I believe the ruling elites really want. So I'll ask you again, what happens when the commies become capitalists? What happens when the capitalists become commies? Deep thoughts to think about. And while you're thinking about that, I want to talk about something that seemingly hasn't made the news, but that's why you're listening to it here on Radio Contra. There's a professor at Harvard University. Oh, wait, who else works at Harvard? Oh, that's right. Presidential candidate and great Senator Elizabeth Pocahontas Warren. But Harvard University, and this is coming from the Department of Justice, so justice.gov for immediate release, Harvard University professor, and two Chinese nationals charged in three separate China-related cases. Uh-oh. The Department of Justice announced today, dated January 28th, 2020, the Department of Justice announced today that the chair of Harvard University's chemistry, of Harvard University's chemistry and chemical biology department, and two Chinese nationals have been charged in connection with aiding the People's Republic of China. Dr. Charles Lieber, 60, the chair of Department of Chemistry and Chemical Biology at Harvard University, was arrested this morning and charged by criminal complaint with one count of making material false, fictitious, and fraudulent statement. Lieber will appear this afternoon before Magistrate Judge Marianne B. Bowler in federal court in Boston, Massachusetts. Yangqing Yi, 29, a Chinese national, was charged in an indictment today with one count each of visa fraud, making false statements, acting as an agent of a foreign government, and conspiracy. Yi is currently in China. Maybe was in China. They'll disappear. Might have got Wu flu. Zhao Songxing, 30, a Chinese national, was arrested December 10, 2019 at Boston's Logan International Airport and charged by criminal complaint with attempting to smuggle 21 vials of biological research to China. On January 21, 2020, Xing was indicted on one count of smuggling goods from the United States and one count of making false, fictitious, or fraudulent statements. He has been detained since December 30th, 2019. So I wonder what was in those vials. I don't know. Let's look at the background of Dr. Charles Lieber. According to court documents, since 2008, Dr. Lieber, who has served as principal investigator of the Lieber Research Group at Harvard University, which specialized in the area of nanoscience, has received more than $15 million in grant funding from the National Institutes of Health and Department of Defense. Uh-oh. These grants required disclosure of significant foreign financial conflicts of interest, including financial support from foreign governments and foreign entities. Unbeknownst to Harvard University, beginning in 2011, Lieber became a strategic scientist at Wuhan University of Technology in China and was a contractual participant in China's Thousand Talents Plan from in or about 2012 to 2017. China's Thousand Talents Plan is one of the most prominent Chinese talent recruit plans that are designed to attract, recruit, and cultivate high-level scientific talent in furtherance of Chinese scientific development, economic prosperity, and national security. These talent programs seek to lure Chinese overseas talent and foreign experts to bring their knowledge and experience to China and reward individuals for stealing proprietary information. Under the terms of Lieber's three-year Thousand Talents contract, WUT paid Lieber $50,000 U.S. per month, living expenses of up to 1 million Chinese yuan, approximately $158,000 at the time, and awarded him with $1.5 million to establish a research lab at WUT. In return, Lieber was obligated to work for WUT not less than 9 months a year by declaring international cooperation projects, cultivating young teachers and PhD students, organizing international conferences, applying for patents, and publishing articles in the name of WUT. The complaint alleges that in 2018 and 2019, Lieber lied about his involvement in the Thousand Talents Plan and his affiliation with WUT. On or about April 24, 2018, during an interview with investigators, Lieber stated he was never asked to participate in the Thousand Talents program, but he wasn't sure how China categorized him. So he was getting paid, but he wasn't. He didn't really know why, right? In November 2018, NIH inquired of Harvard whether Lieber had failed to disclose his then-suspected relationship with WUT and China's Thousand Talents Plan. Lieber caused Harvard to falsely tell NIH that Lieber had no formal association with WUT after 2012. That WUT continued to falsely exaggerate his involvement with WUT in subsequent years. That Lieber is not and has never been a participant in China's Thousand Talents Plan. Yeah, right. So, what about Yanqing Yi? Yanqing Yi is a lieutenant of the People's Liberation Army, the Armed Forces of the People's Republic of China, and member of the Chinese Communist Party. Mm-hmm. Not too many surprises there. What about Zhao Songxing? Xing entered the United States on a J-1 visa, conducted cancer cell research at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston from September 4th, 2018 to December 9th, 2019. It is alleged that Xing stole 21 vials of biological research and attempted to smuggle them out of the United States aboard a flight destined for China. Huh. Wonder what they were up to. In Wuhan, by the way, which is very, very significant. Not like they had a virus just break out from there or anything. My thoughts on it being totally just some guy is that he was working for the United States government and then was turned by the Chinese. That's what I think. And I think that we knew it for some time, or our intelligence agencies knew it for some time. And he is a piece of a larger puzzle. There's a lot of dirty stuff going on. A lot of dirty stuff. And when we have a nation that has a dual system of justice, as we see, I mean, just today, Roger Stone getting sentenced for literally nothing. I mean, point to the real crime that Roger Stone committed. Seriously, I mean, point to it. I don't really think that anybody can. Witness tampering? What witnesses? Has anybody said witness intimidation? He made a false statement. Okay, well, the investigation against him was false. The whole thing was false. It was a false construct. So, I have a lot of difficulty with that. But when we have a dual system of justice, and it seems like one side just doesn't seem to be getting punished, it's kind of concerning. It's kind of concerning. But with this guy, Dr. Lieber, these are the new Rosenbergs, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. They were executed for giving the Soviet Union the bomb, and they became heroes of the American left and the American socialists. They'll tell you. Just ask them. They'll tell you. They gave the Soviet Union nuclear weapons. They gave them the plans for an atomic bomb. Right? They did. They committed treason. They were executed. They got what they earned. You earn what you get. And for anybody to sit there and say, well, how did we not know this professor was also working for the Chinese? Of course we knew. Bullshit. Bullshit. We knew. We knew. And we were allowing it to happen. So I'll ask you again, kind of the running theme. What happens when the commies become capitalists? What happens when the capitalists become communists? It's a good question. How about you? Got training? What's your training schedule looking like? Got a lot of classes coming up, a lot of classes that are filling up very fast. The spring RTO course is overfilled. I've actually got more people in there than I usually feel comfortable teaching. I like to keep the class size around 10. That way I can get good personal interaction with the students. But I've got significantly more students in there now than what's average. And hey, you know, that I'm glad for that. I'm glad for that. A lot of good folks are waking up to the realities. They're looking at holes in their training and coming out. And I am damn proud to have them. But we've got a signals intelligence course coming up in May on the 2nd and 3rd. Out in Tennessee. Come check that out. The following weekend, I will be at Heritage Life Skills in Waynesville, North Carolina. So if you're thinking about coming out, checking out some really cool seminars, there's going to be a ton of people there giving out really good classes. And I think almost all the classes are free. I know mine are. I'm teaching three different things there. It's an hour and a half seminar each, and I'll have a booth. So, you know, come out, check it out. I will be honored to meet you, you know, and hang out a little bit, kind of ask questions, socialize. I love doing these events. So you get to meet some really cool people. RTO and advanced RTO. I've got that coming up in Wisconsin, 25th. Through the 28th of June. The readout communications course that is earlier that June, it's like first week in June, is a week long. That one is full, but I have another one coming up in September, the 15th through the 20th of September out in Wyoming. It's $300 per course individually, or all three for $800. And that is RTO, advanced RTO, and signals intelligence. So come check it out. You know, you get all three, get the week-long experience, and, you know, knock a little bit off on the costs as well. I'm telling you, once you get to that first RTO course, it's just my experience with the students. Once you get through that first RTO course, you're going to want those other two. You just are, you know, that is the most frequent complaint that I've got from any of those classes individually, is that people want to have all three of them compressed together. That way there's no gaps in the knowledge. You don't forget anything. Everything's fresh in your head and you're really jumping right into it. And these are the only classes of their kind that are taught anywhere that I'm aware of. You know, RTO and advanced RTO, their communications courses, they are not ham radio classes. I've got that question a bunch of times in emails. They are not ham radio classes. They are not even a lot of the old time hams come and take that class, and their heads want to spin because we don't do ham radio things. I do communications things. I teach people how to communicate, improvised communications, working in a grid down, non-permissive environment. How would you build a communications plan on little to no resources? And that's how we do it. That is what we cover in the course. So come check it out. And while you're at it, check out site sponsor and my friend Bob Griswold over at Ready Made Resources, dealer of great night vision equipment. I've got one of the Gen 3 Plus White Phosphorus PVS 14s right now that I am playing with and having a heck of a lot of fun using. And I'm going to tell you, I've got an older PVS 14 with the old Gen 3 green tubes. White phosphor tubes blow this thing out of the water. White phosphor tubes, it is the best night vision you can use, period. You know, end of discussion. It is the best thing on the market. And, you know, yeah, the initial cost is expensive, but hey, it's worth it. It is worth it. You know, so save your pennies. quit drinking beer for a few months, you know, give up cigarettes. You should probably quit smoking anyway, but, you know, save the money. Seriously, save the money. Night Vision is worth it. Night Vision is absolutely worth it. And, I think this fall I'm going to be offering a course. I'm not 100% on it yet, but I think I'm going to be offering a course. It'll probably go along with fighting carbine stuff that I do. But where we are operating specifically at night, fighting carbine at night, using night vision, using PEG 15, a laser, whatever laser setup you have, and going from there. I think that would be really productive to get some folks out and do that and cover that material, because it's important. And, you know, I'll tell you, the ability to fight at night is terrifying to an opponent, even if they have night vision capability. And let's be honest, a lot of folks don't. But if they don't have the ability to fight at night and you do, well, you own the battle space. I mean, period, plain and simple. And there's a lot of really good equipment out there. You know, night vision equipment, there's a lot of really good stuff, but I strongly urge you to look at Gen 3 equipment. You know, Gen 1 stuff, the old infrared imager tubes, you know, you need the IR illuminator on, you know, to be able to use them, unless it's, you know, you've got a lot of illume out that night. And I'm not saying that those don't work, because they do, but they don't compare in quality and longevity to Gen 3 sets. They just don't. So you're getting better equipment. I'm telling you, the investment of a PVS 14, and I don't get anything out of that. I'm just telling you. I mean, he sells lower end equipment. A lot of the other companies, you know. ATN is also an affiliate of American Partisan. They sell a wide variety of equipment as well. But I'm telling you, buy the best that you can. You know, you can spend a little less money on a carbine. You could spend a little less money on a day optic. Save that money and spend it on good night vision. All right. Get your night vision capabilities squared away, and then you're going to be able to fight at night. And you will thank me later on, I promise. But anyway, with that said, I had a interesting email that I wanted to share with you. I wrote up a post earlier. I wrote up a couple of them dealing with the Kalashnikov. I've had some really good results with Palmetto State Armory's GF3. There, I think that stands for Gen 3 Forged Trunnion, because they're using forged trunnions now, as opposed to their first generation where they were using cast. And, you know, you don't want to do that on a Kalashnikov. But I've had a number of questions. I had some comments that were really good. I had a couple comments that were just retarded, whatever. You know, you know who you are. If you read comments on blogs, especially gun firearm stuff, you know the types of people I'm talking about. Man, it is what it is. But the emails that I get every so often, I'll get some that are really, really interesting, and this one was really good. Scout, saw your article on the year of the AK, talking about the, you know, is 2020 the year of the AK kind of in the mainstream. And I talked a little bit about, you know, how it's American made AKs are kind of coming into their own. Anyway, interesting. Bottom line up front, please consider a post or two covering adequate AK for novice user and main considerations to look for. Also, a short list of recommended ammunition to feed the beast, and maybe known good magazines. Details. I used the AK in 2003. It was a Battlefield pickup with Arabic scribblings on it. Worked fine. Intuitive to operate. Just thinking now might be the time to pick up one or two as training tools and quality training ammo for it. I've looked at Palmetto State Armory and Kalashnikov, I'm assuming Kalashnikov USA's offerings. I don't know what I don't know. I do know that I can't afford to waste our limited resources. A lot of people are in that boat, brother. I'm thinking stamped receiver is fine if the trunnion is set up right. Plastic furniture is okay too. Like I said, I don't know much about them beyond picking one up, load, fire, and reduce stoppage to basic operator maintenance. Any help or any, or I appreciate any help you care to provide. So that's a really good question, and it's one that I think if people are new to the AK platform, they're just kind of tiptoeing into the waters. It's a question a lot of people have. So a little background with me in the AK, I've wrote about this in the past, but I've owned several AKs, really too many to mention, but with that said, I've owned several since the early 2000s and got the opportunity to run a couple on some missions overseas and never really got serious with training with it, though, until I was in the Army. And when I got to Fort Bragg, I knew, you know, what we were going to do, and I knew when we were training up for deployment that we were going to be partnered with Afghans, an elite unit from the Afghan police, that we were going to be partnered with them, and we were going to have to do a lot of cross training. And so I started really digging into different training with the AK because, you know, we might as well get serious about it, you know. Training with this thing. There's other guys you're going to be working with specifically that are going to be carrying this thing. And that led me to a variety of different trainers. And in Fayetteville, especially around Fort Bragg, the AK is extremely common. There's a lot of dudes down there with some serious man killer creds that love the AK. It's got a pretty serious following. And the builder community, the AK builder community, is kind of a outgrowth of that around Fort Bragg, too. So it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool to be in that environment, learn some things, run across some interesting folks. And I learned a shit ton about the Kalashnikov as well. So what I'll say about getting your first AK, kind of AK 101. I looked at Palmetto State Armory and Kalashnikov USA's offerings. I can't attest to Kalashnikov USA because I haven't owned anything from them. I have, however, you know, I've got a Palmetto State AK in my hands. Been working with that for a while now. I'm going to beat on it again this coming weekend in a carbine class. And, you know, which the fighting carbine class I teach is all AR-based. But I do a little bit of hands-on with the AK just to as familiarization and kind of to show the students in class what the differences are, you know, why the AR is faster. Because it is. I'll say, man, you can't go wrong with Palmetto State Armory. You really can't. And I don't have any cause for concern out of this thing so far. With that said, do not overlook the Century Arms Wasser 10. All right. The Wasser 10 is built at Seeger in Romania. It looks like Cougar, but it's pronounced Seeger. Cougars are the older ladies you pick up at the bar. Lost my train of thought, but Seeger AKs, I mean, Wasser 10s, the Arsenal AKs that are produced in Bulgaria, And I would say even the Polish AKs are being produced in Radom, as well as by the Yugo AKs, Serbian AKs that are made in Zastava. They're all made on machinery that has been building AKs for 60 plus years. It's an uphill battle for the American companies to get into it. And, with all those foreign offerings that I named off, you cannot go wrong with any of those. Absolutely. I honestly think that the best quality or best bang for the buck AK on the market right now is a Wasser 10. Take the wood furniture and chuck it off in the woods somewhere, because you don't need that. And invest in the Russian 100 series, AK 100 series polymer. Really all you need is a polymer lower handguard. The lower handguard is obviously the lower half of the handguard. It's two pieces. There's a top piece that covers the gas tube. It just kind of slides around it. And then you have the lower handguard. And, replace that sucker with the Russian polymer one. Romanian guns, Polish guns, Hungarian guns, Bulgarian guns, they all have that standard AKM pattern. So they'll all, for the most part, have furniture interchangeability. The Yugo guns are different. The Zastava M70 series is proprietary. They have different dimensions. So that's going to be a little bit of a challenge. It's something to know. Palmetto State Armory uses that standard AKM stamp design as well, that AKM pattern. So all the furniture, for the most part, is going to be interchangeable. You might have to do a little minor fitting with a file here and there on stuff. But that AK-100 series polymer is very rugged, first of all, and it also has a heat shield built into it. Wood handguards do not. So even though, like on this Palmetto State AK, I've got the laminate wood looks really good, would I use that in combat? No. No, not if I had the choice. Polymer is much better with a heat shield in there. It doesn't hold heat nearly as long with the heat shield inside of it. And, wood does. Woods, even laminate wood, will swell with humidity. I've seen it said before that, FUDs out there on some of the FUD blogs or FUD forums and whatnot saying laminate stocks don't warp with humidity. That's bullshit. They do. Polymer doesn't. Polymer is rot resistant, mildew resistant. It's not going to mold on you. It's not going to crack. So you'll be good to go. The gas tube on a combat or on an AK that I'm setting up specifically for combat, I replaced the gas tube with an Ultimac. I can't say enough good things about the Ultimac. Ultimac's been around a long time. There's two U-bolts that go around the barrel and it bolts into place. It is simple. It is rugged. It is effective. And, it can be really a one-stop shop too for mounting not only a tack light, if you're going to run a tack light on your AK, as well as something like an Aimpoint T1 or a micro red dot. So I mean, it's worth having. It's worth adding. And you got your side rail on there on the side that gets caught on t-shirts when you're doing reflexive fire and whatnot. There's some guys out there that are diehard AK guys that really love the side rail. I am not one of them. There's some companies that make really good side rail products. RS Mounts makes a really good one. I've got an optic and a mount on their 30 millimeter ring mount, and it's nice. The problem I have with it is that it throws the balance of the weapon off. I'm kind of picky about that. When I'm doing reflexive fire, I like everything to be centerline to the bore. And I don't like weight distribution to be off to one side or the other. And it's just my experience and my the way I handle the AK, I guess, that it feels like there's too much weight on the left side of the gun. I just don't like it. It feels weird to me, so I just don't like it. There are some mounts. Texas Weapon Systems makes a top cover mount, replaces the top cover. I've got one of the first generation ones laying around here somewhere. Had it on an AK, worked okay, held zero for the most part. When you disassemble whatever, you need to go out and reconfirm your zero just to be on the safe side. But the newer models are pretty good. They've got a couple generations since then that they've made in the decade that they've been produced. And, you know, they're okay. I don't run one on any of my weapons. I have one AK. It is a Wasser 10 that I consider a go-to-war AK. The rest of them are training weapons for familiarization. And, you know, and to train students and to use as a Op 4 weapons in the scout course that I teach, which is a small unit tactics course. But, you know, I mean, the Ultimac, I feel like, is the way to go as far as optics mounts. And again, you can't go wrong with Palmetto State Armory. I think that they're cranking out some really good stuff. And, you know, I'm not just saying that because the site has an affiliation with them. I'm saying it because, you know, I am working with the weapon. And if I run into problems, I'm going to say so. Further, ammunition, recommended ammunition. You know, ammunition with the AK, a lot of the old knowledge was, you know, buy whatever's cheapest and, you know, 1,000 rounds of the cheapest crap you can find and you know, whatever. But all AK ammo, for the most part, that comes from Russia is all the steel case stuff is fairly inexpensive. What I will say is look for 8M3 or 8MIC3. It was an anti-personnel round that was developed by the Russian government for use in Chechnya. And that stuff is awesome. It is a guaranteed expansion round. It has pre-fail cuts cut into the hollow point. And you can identify this. It's made by Tool Ammo. However, I have found an 8M3 clone in Wolf Military Classic as well. Now, I know that there's probably going to be somebody out there that listens to this and says, oh, no, there's no way, blah, blah, blah. But, nah, I totally did. And one way that you can know that is to take a small paperclip, push it down into the hollow point, and rub it on the inside of the bullet itself. And if you feel those pre-fail cuts, there will be little grooves in there, then you know what you've got. It's 124 grain hollow point. And the hollow point is a little bit larger than other AK hollow points, like Brown Bear, 123 grain. There's 122 grain Tula hollow point as well. And those pretty much behave, in my experience, they behave exactly like Full Metal Jacket. There are some old timers out there. They'll say, oh, you need to buy, you know, Yugo ammo. The Yugo ammo is boat tail or whatever. Yeah, okay. But the stuff's also corrosive. And I don't really want to deal with corrosive ammo. If you do have corrosive ammo, the way you neutralize it is by using Windex, the ammonia neutralizes the salts, but that caused the corrosion. But I'd rather just avoid that altogether. And I to be honest, I don't know of any of the Yugo ammo, the old Yugo corrosive ammo, that's on the market anymore. I think it's all dried up. But yeah. So I would say really the other things to look for in an AK, make sure the trunnions are forged. You know, I'll just call them out by name. IO Incorporated. If you see any AK that says IO Incorporated on it, just walk away from that thing. They're dangerous. You know, yeah, I said it. That AK using any AK that uses cast parts as the front trunnion, because the front trunnion is where almost all of the force of that action is centered. And the barrel goes in there mates up to the receiver. It is the trunnion slides into the receiver. The barrel pin is pinned in place, and then it is riveted in place into the receiver. And, you know, you want to make sure those parts are forged because they're going to be stronger. If they're cast, they're not strong enough. And I saw people that were defending some of these piles of junk by saying, well, Ruger has used cast receivers for, you know, decades on the Mini 14, and they work just fine. Well, maybe they do. The Mini 14 is a completely different weapon. Yeah, the Mini 30 is a completely different weapon. The action's completely different. And, you know, I don't know of anybody that really runs a Mini 14 or a Mini 30 as hard as people run AKs. So that argument is kind of stupid. But, you know, whatever. But anyway, as far as that goes, you know, IO Incorporated, the RAS 47 uses cast trunnions. You know, if any of you that are listening to this out there and you're like, oh, I got a RAS 47, works great. Yeah, well, maybe it does, man, but it's going to end up losing headspace. And once an AK loses headspace, that thing is dangerous to operate. So look up some of the videos. I mean, there are videos aplenty out there, on this, and AK Operators Union, Robski over there, he does a 5,000 round test that's really good. And I mean, I don't think anybody in their right mind would say that what he does with the AKs is not somehow it's not objective, because it is. And, you know, so go over there and check them out. But as far as the AK goes, this is pretty much the guidelines. You know, a lot of my preferences with the AK are really kind of personal, like my personal choice of this or that or the other. You know, Palmetto State's good to go. I think the Wasser 10s are really the best bang for the buck on the market. So, you know, they're really, really good. And you've got a chrome lined barrel. And the Wasser 10s of today, and at least the past 5-6 years, are not the Wasser 10s that were wore out parts kits of the early 2000s. So that's something to keep in mind, too. You know, I'm not saying that you're getting the best looking weapon in the world, because, you know, Eastern Bloc countries are very much function over form. You know, you're not getting the most aesthetically pleasing looking thing in the world, but you're definitely getting a weapon that works. Now, you know, with that said, I think the last thing that I'll say regarding that, magazines, make sure with the magazines that if you're getting steel, that you're not buying the KCI Korean mags. Don't sidestep those. They will give you problems. I promise they will give you problems, specifically in the feed lips. They will give you issues. Every one of those that I've ever had that I've took out of the woods and beat on and used for more serious purposes has ended up failing me one way or another. So don't even bother with the KCIs. If you're getting steel, make sure it is surplus steel. Make sure some government entity that also produces AKs built it. And you'll probably be good to go. But, you know, South Korea does not use the AK as a primary weapon. You know, they're just making cheap metal, pot metal AK mags there, so don't use those. When it comes to polymer mags, the market has gotten a lot better on that over the years. With polymer magazines, I've got some that I just use on the range only that I really just don't care what happens to them. The Magpul, the original Magpul P-Mags, I bought a bundle of those when they came out. The AK mag is very different from an AR-15 magazine. It has different requirements to its strength. And you have to make sure that the front locking lug is made out of steel and that the rear locking lug is made out of steel as well. And preferably the feed lips are as well. The Arsenal Circle 10 mags, the waffle mags, are really good. There are some other Bulgarian slab side mags that have steel lined feed lips as well. That seem to be pretty strong. Got a couple of those from Gun Mag Warehouse. And, for a long time, the Arsenal Circle 10, Bulgarian mags were really the gold standard for everything. But that's kind of changed. Like, Magpul's come out with a third-gen magazine that's got steel-lined feed lips, front lug, rear lug. The body is reinforced. And I've got one. It's a really good mag. And another really good one that's out there is X-Tech Tactical. Jeremy Deadman out in Arizona producing those, and I've got two of those. He sent out two to me for review, and man, those things, I've had them for a little over a year now, right at a year, I think, and I got them last year. There was a snowstorm going on when they came in, and we've got some snow that has come in today, and it was last winter, sometime last winter, but I've been running those since then. And man, you're talking about just a really, really good magazine. I've ordered several since then. And, definitely gets a go from my end. So if you're looking for a good quality magazine and, you're trying to keep your money in America, maybe that's important to you. Maybe not. Check out X-Tech Tactical and check out Magpul as well. They're both making really good ones. There might be a couple other companies I'm not really aware of so much. There's another one, Toth Machine and Tool, I think is what they're called. Toth. T-O-T-H, I think. I'll have to look them up. But they were making an American version of that Circle 10 AK mag as well. And seemed to be pretty nice. There was a lot of buzz surrounding that. I don't know if they ended up getting it off the ground or not. I haven't heard anything else about it. But if anybody from there is listening, hey, I'll be your testing guy, if you want to send one out. But anyway, there's a lot of good options. A lot of good options for running the AK. And, the last thing that I will say about the AK, and I think that it needs to be said, because I got some really good comments, and I got some really the usual comments, and I got some others that were just kind of bizarre. But as far as this versus that mentality, be deadly with everything in your hands. How about that? I like to be the master of many weapons. I like to be and to train myself to be the most dangerous person in that battle space. And if part of that entails me mastering a large number of weapons, then I think that it is very, that's a very important point of view to have. I don't worship at the altar of a weapon system. All right, a weapon is a tool in the toolbox. Now, when it comes to my preferences, like what would I pick up in the middle of the night? Well, I don't know. Yeah, whatever's closest to me. But as far as weapon selection goes, you know, you get people that love to argue about this on the internet. Typically, in my experience, none of those people have usually fired shots in anger, with rare couple of exceptions I can think of. I'm going to be using whatever tools my mission requires. How about that? Anyway, with that said, you know, you should be training with foreign weapons. You should be integrating foreign weapons training, or at least familiarization, outside of your usual training regimen. You should be introducing that into what you're doing. Because our neighbors down to the south who really don't like us are building 50,000 of them per year starting last year. And I think that number might have went up to 70. There's some reports floating around, but I can't independently verify it. But don't worry, I will. But they're also producing ammo as well as quite a bit of other stuff. So if we are well underway into 2020 now, that means that there's a whole lot of brand new AKs, the 7.62x39 floating around out there, and they don't have that many people in their army of Venezuela. So where are those guns going? Where are those guns going? And where is their other equipment going? Because they're getting a whole lot of equipment being brought in as a Russian client state. And some of it's accounted for, some of it's not. So something to think about. And Venezuela is not that far away from the southeastern United States. Does that mean that there would be some sort of Red Dawn invasion? Oh, no. No, no, no. Does that mean that if, for whatever reason, there was civil chaos here, would they maybe be part of a stabilizing force? Yes, they might. It's just something to think about. Could I be wrong about that? I don't know. The logistics support it. And going back to our notes on China, China has made major moves in the Caribbean, as well as maintaining very close ties with those old former Russian client states as well. And China has also made it very clear that they want the United States off the world stage. They want to be the lone superpower of the 21st century. If they don't all die from Wu flu, am I right? All right, guys, it's been a blast. Hopefully there will not be another four-week, three-week, however long it's been since the last episode break. In the episodes, I should have a little bit more time on my hands. Training schedule is going to let up a little bit and then get it really intense towards the end of March. So hopefully I'll have more time to share with you. But as always, it is an honor, and I look forward to training with you in any of the upcoming classes. If you have any questions at all, hit me up, brushbeater@tutanota.com, AmericanPartisan.org, brushbeater.wordpress.com. This is NC Scout, out.